my main impetus as an artist is to be a creative force as a composer and as a player. And what I want to do as a creative person is to be making the music that I hear in my heart and in my mind.
That's James Falzone, a composer and clarinetist with an exploring spirit and the ability to inspire and compose for musicians of many different backgrounds. He's also one of the featured artists at this year's Michigan Festival of Sacred Music. Mr. Falzone's first concert will be Saturday, November 16th at 3 p.m. at the Holy Family Chapel at Nazareth Center on Gull Road. It's a solo meditation called Sighs Too Deep for Words, highlighting the vocal qualities of the clarinet as well as some of the more unusual timbres it can achieve and the addition of ambient sounds and bells. Later Saturday night, he'll present a program with his group Alos Musica, featuring clarinet, accordion, the oud, and hand percussion. It's at 8 p.m., also at the Holy Family Chapel. Full details are at mfsm.us. Like many artists I talk to these days, for James Falzone, the label jazz player, or classical artist, or folk musician, doesn't really begin to describe the music in his heart.
Primarily, I'm known as a jazz musician. I mean, that's sort of like how I get categorized. And because I think of jazz as a very open music, then I'm happy to wear that hat. But on any given night, you could hear me playing wildly different music that I would not categorize as jazz. And so, you know, I just have to question whether these categories are helpful any longer. And I recognize why they're there, and I think it's just human nature. We like to put things in some kind of a silo, you know, some kind of a drawer, so we know when to pull it out and what we're going to get when we open that drawer. But increasingly in the arts, it's really impossible. And those of us working more in the kind of, I don't know, you know, front end of the arts, the more experimental arts, we're happy to keep blurring those lines. And, of course, they've been blurry all along, but the bigger the industry gets, the bigger the industry, the more the industry needs the drawers.
Well, if I may change the imagery from drawers to, say, a container of dry ice that has been opened and the fog is spread everywhere, that is what I am looking at when I'm looking at your biography. I don't know where to begin, and so my instinct is to ask you to put all that smoke back into that tiny little bit of dry ice and tell me, where did this all begin? Did you grow up as a white kid who loved jazz in Chicago?
Well, I love the dry ice metaphor. This is fantastic. Yes, white guy in Chicago, growing up in just outside of Chicago in a nice little suburb, and you know, middle class parents who raised me well, and thankfully had an uncle who was a musician and is still a musician. He's a wonderful musician. He's a saxophonist and also a film composer, and he's made his living in Hollywood writing for film and television. And he's actually, it's a nice connection to the Sacred Music Festival in that he went to college with Paul Winter, who's playing the next night after I play on Sunday at the Sacred Music Festival. And Paul Winter, as I'm sure you know, went on to have a wonderful career as a kind of founder of the New Age music. And he's, you know, quasi-jazz musician also. Well, I mean, he's more than just a quasi-jazz musician. He's a really great musician who's made his mark mostly in kind of more spiritual-ended New Age music. And Uncle Jim, my uncle James DePasquale, whom I was named after partly, he went to college with Paul and was in some of Paul's early bands. And so all my life I've known about Paul Winter, so it's great to be playing on the same festival as him. Quite an honor, really. But Uncle Jim, when I first started expressing interest in music when I was 10, I had a good public school music teacher. They existed then, and they did good work then. And she introduced us to the instruments and introduced us to music. And I just thought it would be fun to play an instrument. And I had no background in it. My parents aren't necessarily musical. They have a great love of the arts and my uncle's influence on my mom's life. It's her brother, I think, was present. So when I expressed an interest in playing an instrument, mom said, well, let's call Uncle Jim. And I had seen a flashcard of the clarinet. The teacher would show us flashcards, and we would have to name the instruments of the orchestra. And I thought the clarinet looked kind of cool, which is funny because most people don't think that, but something about the black and the silver keys and whatnot, I just thought it looked interesting. And Uncle Jim is a saxophonist who also, as a lot of saxophonists will, doubled on clarinet and flute and so forth. So we called him, and he found an instrument for me. He was living in Los Angeles, but through his contacts here in Chicago, which is where he grew up, he found an instrument for me and got me hooked up with a great teacher. And Uncle Jim has really been the kind of was the main influence there. And in particular to the kind of wide interest that you're alluding to with the dry ice and so forth, is that Uncle Jim at an early age would take me to the record store, the vinyl record store when they existed, and we would go in and he would just buy different records for me. And I remember specifically one visit he was in for Christmas, and he took me to the store as a Christmas present, and he bought me Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. He bought me a Charlie Parker record. He bought me the Beatles' White Album. And he bought me some music of Josquin du Pré, who was one of the early music Renaissance composers. And he didn't say that this is jazz, this is classical, this is rock, this is early music. He just gave the records to me and said, you know, listen to these, and I'll be back at Easter, and then we'll buy some more records. And that's what I did. And I was just... I fell in love with sound and with music, and I didn't really have anybody telling me that these were different kinds of music. So in one day, I would jump from Charlie Parker to Stravinsky and just kind of make comparisons and enjoy them for what they were. Later on, as I got older and so forth and kept on studying and got into high school and was in bands and whatnot, then I began to see, okay, Charlie Parker comes from this era and this tradition, and Stravinsky is, you know, in some ways not related, but in some ways he is related. And Charlie Parker was very interested in Stravinsky. And so I was constantly making relationships between all these things. And when I got into college and then further into graduate school, I specifically indulged those interests. So, for instance, in undergraduate school, I was a classical clarinet major, so I played in all the orchestras and the wind ensembles and chamber music ensembles, but I also played saxophone in the jazz ensembles and in small groups, and I also studied a lot of ethnic music, particularly Arabic music, and at that time I was really interested in Irish music and was playing tin whistle and penny whistle and learning a lot of that music, and so I just kept all these... You know, that experience of hearing lots of different kinds of music as a youngster, as a 10-year-old, I just never lost that sense and just kept on pushing ahead and tried to define myself as a player who could actually do all those things. And I've worked, you know, pretty hard at that so that I'm not just dabbling, but if you want to sit down and play Mozart, I can sit down and play Mozart. If you want to sit down and play some standard jazz tunes, I can do that. If you want to, to have me play, interpret some Arabic music, I can do that. And now, of course, I have things that I'm more geared towards and things that fill me with more passion than other things. So I try to focus on those. But I've really tried to study and to be a great student of music and to humble myself before this amazing art that, you know, I have spent all my time thinking about and still haven't even scratched the surface of. So, long story short, but I think answering your question directly, it really goes back to my uncle and his ability to school me in a very open-minded way, and that's what started the way I think about music, and increasingly more as I'm an educator now, and I teach here in Chicago, and that's opening up more now, especially in the last 5 or 6 years, to all of the arts. So that kind of ecumenical view was always there for music, but now it's increasingly becoming about visual art, about film, about dance. So I'm always been interested in crossing disciplines and trying to find the connection points, because they truly exist for me, those connection points. They're not just fabricated. They're really there.
I'd like to talk about learning Arabic music. I mean, in undergraduate school, students learn terrifying things about music from other cultures, like that ragas can go on for hundreds of notes and there are microtones, and it's just mind-boggling and terrifying. You just sort of stick to the old eight-note scale. And
for sure, yeah.
What is going on in Arabic music? And perhaps you can relate that to, say, a person learning another kind of folk music. Is it by ear only? What kind of study do you have to do?
Well, a great question and a big question. And I certainly don't want to misrepresent myself as somebody who is some kind of expert in this music. It's something that I've fallen in love with at a young age from purely the sound of it. And I can tell you specifically, it might be an interesting thing to hear, is that it came specifically through Peter Gabriel's records. If you know the pop artist Peter Gabriel, back in the 80s when I was a junior high school kid, he had these amazing records coming out that had all of these world music influences. And I was just fascinated by the pure sound of them, just on the color of sound level of those records. And so I would look on the record sleeves and find out what instruments they were. And very often they were instruments of Arabic descent, in particular the ney flute, which is an Arabic flute. He would also have the oud on some of his records, and he would have African drums and North African percussionists and whatnot. And so I would find out what those instruments were, and then I would go find records from those instruments. So it really was the interest for me was purely sound at first. But then, as you say, rightly, when you start to look at that music, and if you're schooled in Western classical music and you've got so much to deal with just as that is, you know, trying to learn harmony and counterpoint and the history of the music, let alone trying to learn jazz, which I was always doing as a high school student and college student, that's enough, right? But then to try to think about, all right, what's happening in this centuries-old tradition of Arabic music that in many ways predates Western classical music, and in some ways, very important ways, influence the tradition of Western classical music. For instance, the early church modes, which is the basis of our Western theory, in my opinion, has its roots in music coming out of Andalusia, coming out of North Africa, and the influence in particular from some Arabic musicians who were living in North Africa and influencing Spain, which then got into mainland Europe and so forth. So the transmutation, the conflation of Arabic theory and Western theory is rich. And that was what sparked my interest. I took a world music class maybe as a sophomore as an undergraduate, and just reading texts and listening to music about different kinds of music from around the world. It was a survey class, so pretty, not very deep, but just sort of topical. But I would, again, make those connection points, and then I would kind of mark these files in my head, say, okay, check that out more. Ragas sound really interesting. Arabic music seems like it's really connected to Western music, and et cetera. And so then I just began to study a bit more specifically. Okay, what is a maqam? A maqam is a mode that is used in Arabic music, and indeed many of them have microtones. So for your listeners who might not be familiar with that idea, these are pitches in between the black and white notes, black and white keys on the piano. And these pitches are not just mistakes. You know, when you first hear that music, you might think, oh, this singer or this flute player sounds like they're out of tune. Well, they are out of tune if you're tuning it to a Western tempered scale. But these are whole other modes that exist, which make use of microtones in a very beautiful and very specific, in some ways, very rigid way. The same kind of rules apply in that music as they do, say, in the counterpoint of Bach or Western classical music. And so, I took some classes, I read a lot of books, and most importantly, I listened and hung out with musicians who were masters in that music. And here in Chicago, there are a number of you know, fantastic musicians from Middle Eastern descent who live here and who are experts and masters in the music. And I've taken classes with them and hung out with them and gone to Middle Eastern grocery stores and found CDs and tapes and things, and spent time talking to people about the music. And after several years of study of that music, I wanted to form a group, which is the Alos Musica Ensemble, that would indulge my interest in that. But I was careful, and this is important, I was careful not to make a traditional music group, because I didn't feel like that was what I could bring to the music. My main impetus as an artist is to be a creative force as a composer and as a player. And what I want to do as a creative person is to be making the music that I hear in my heart and in my mind. And that's not traditional Arabic music. That's some kind of a hybrid that's combining my training as a classical musician, my training as a jazz musician, and my interest and love in different kinds of world music styles. But the trick has been to create an ensemble and to create music that is not just like world music soup, you know. It's kind of funny because just before you called, I was making soup for a little party I'm having tonight. And, you know, I'm throwing all kinds of stuff in there. I'm like, oh, we got some leftover this, put that in there. And I've got this some stock to put in and base of carrots and leeks and whatnot. And I just, you know, that's a great way to cook, but not the way that I want to make music. It's not about just like grabbing a little bit of this, grabbing a little bit of that, and it's trying to take all those things that are the kind of DNA of who I am as a musician and trying to find a specific way to compose music that alludes to that DNA but is true to my own musical voice. And so, again, circling back to your direct question, I was just never afraid of that study because that study was in service and has always been in service of my own musical vision and my musical aspirations. And that's a very composerly thing, I think. Composers are hungry for material. And if you're just a player, if you're just, let's just say, somebody playing in an orchestra, which is a worthy pursuit and one that I respect immensely. But yeah, learning a whole bunch of other scales and trying to learn music that is using microtones seems like an awful lot of work when you've got so much music to deal with in the orchestra repertoire, etc. But when you're a composer, you're always looking for new resources. And that's something that Stravinsky did, that Olivier Messiaen did, that Morton Feldman did. I mean, composers are always hungry for, you know, for material. And that's really what I've been after as well. So the study of Arabic music and other kinds of music has always been in service of a personal voice. And I think, you know, I just turned 42 2 months ago now, since it's November, and I feel like only now am I making sense of all that stuff in a way that is really starting to make sense to me. That's good. I'm glad to be there, but I feel like up till now I've been, you know, working hard and trying to articulate that voice, and certainly some of it's been there, but I finally feel like maybe now I'm speaking with the voice that I really want to be speaking with.
It's funny how with music there's highly active study periods and then sort of inactive periods that allow your brain to be processing all of the sounds and then come up with an original voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you have to let these things sit for a while. And I think, I'm sorry to keep making the analogy, but the soup that's bubbling upstairs, you know, I'm going to let it simmer up there for most of the afternoon. And if I just started eating it now, it certainly wouldn't have a whole lot of definition of flavor and taste. But it by 5 o'clock tonight, I think it'll be pretty good. But it you know, and using that as a metaphor, I've needed a lot of time to let all this study and the hard work kind of find its way and come to the surface. And of course, that's a never-ending, lifelong process, which is why it's so wonderful to be involved in this work. But certainly, at some point, you know, when you play a concert, like I will in Kalamazoo, or when you put a record out, or when you put yourself out there, you have to say, okay, this is a statement of how I'm hearing things, how I'm seeing things at this moment. 6 months from now, it might be a little different. It'll change. It'll be added to. But here is a statement right now. And if you think about it in that way, on a continuum, you know, that it's ever changing, I think then music and the arts in general become a much more open and free possibility, you know. And so
Yeah, I agree with you totally about the work and letting it sit for a while.
I wanted to say aha earlier when you were talking about meeting musicians who came from the Arabic tradition and actually getting to share space and music with them. I feel that's always a huge component to spend time in a room with these players. And maybe you would tell me about the Alos Musica Ensemble, the folks who are in it, and what they contribute to the group as a whole.
Yes, that's a great question. Let me start with the newest member, who's I guess at this point one of my oldest playing partners, Jeremiah McLean, who is an accordionist from Vermont, and he's lived in Vermont all of his life except for years when he lived in France. And although he's an American, Jeremiah is somebody who is so versed in other kinds of music, particularly French music and Celtic music. And when I say Celtic, I'm not just sort of talking about that kind of watered-down Celtic sound that we hear a lot, but Jeremiah truly knows the sort of tradition of Celtic music as it exists in Scotland and Canada and Ireland and the British Isles and whatnot. And in particular, he's, I would go so far as to say, one of the sort of American masters of Breton music, music from Brittany, which is the far west coast of France.
Wow.
And when I met him in graduate school at the New England Conservatory in Boston, going on, gosh, I guess that's, 15 years ago now, something like that, he introduced me to that music, and that music has a history of the clarinet in it, which I did not know. And so anytime there's clarinet involved, I'm all game. And so I started learning the music from him. And I just became fascinated because it's music that is ripe for improvisation, which I'm always interested in. And the modes that the music was in, I recognized as having kind of Arabic leanings to them. They were also modes that were early church modes. They sort of sounded medieval-like, and the way the melodies turned sounded very Celtic, but it just had this really interesting hybrid going on that I recognized. And so he and I have played this music all over the place at this point, and have had several different groups over the years, but I've added him to the Alos group, and I think it's actually this tour will be the first time he's playing with this ensemble, and I have no doubt that it'll be just a really easy match because I've played with him for so long and he knows a lot of this music anyway. And so he'll be bringing this really rich tradition of Breton music.
I own an Irish button accordion BC Rose, and I know I couldn't get microtones if I tried, and I can barely get more than 3-4 scales out of it. So do you know anything about the instrument that he uses?
Yeah, he's a piano accordion player, which is a little different for a traditional music
sure.
player to be playing that. But and his whole history is quite fascinating, how he got into it and so forth. He was originally a piano player, and so it was a little easier for him to be playing piano accordion. But what he can do on the piano accordion is really special. Now, granted, there's no microtones involved. He can actually bend some pitches, which is he does through a certain kind of extended technique on the accordion. But the music that I'm creating for this ensemble, in its the construction of the music, is not microtonal. The way we'll improvise sometimes can make use of those modes, but the music itself is not necessarily microtonal. But so he's playing piano accordion and diatonic, and but in a way that I think listeners will really enjoy. And he has this really strong dance sense to his music. He's played for dances for many, many years around the world. Contra dances and Irish dances and so forth. So there's this kind of groove that he brings to everything that I think will be really wonderful with this group. Back to the members of the group, the other person before I get to the oud player, who is certainly the most person in the Arabic tradition, the percussionist is Tim Mulvena, who is one of the really the country's best jazz drummers and certainly one of the top call jazz drummers in Chicago. And what a lot of people don't know about Tim is that in addition to being an incredible set player, drum set player, he plays hand drums from all over the world. And he's a
just an absolute voracious student of hand drum technique. So he plays frame drums from North Africa, and he plays drums from Central and other Western Africa, and he plays the rick very well, which is a tambourine from the Middle East, and anything that can rattle or shake or you can beat with your fingers, Tim will figure out some way to coax incredible rhythms out of. And he's just a real student of different types of drumming. And I've played with Tim in many jazz contexts. In fact, the first time I ever played with him was playing swing music, Benny Goodman, a Benny Goodman kind of ghost band. This was back in the mid-90s when that music was really popular. And that's when I first met him, and then found out more about his love and interest in hand drums and so forth, and frame drums. And so he plays those instruments in this group and brings just an incredible depth of understanding of rhythm to the project. And then Ronnie Malley, who is an American-born Palestinian, and he lives here in Chicago, grew up here in Chicago, but his family is from Ramallah. And he plays the oud, which is the Arabic lute. And the oud is an incredible instrument that the more I learn about it, the more I realize what a strong influence and important influence it's had on Western music. I think really it's not too much of an extreme to say that the guitar, as we know it today, you know, has the fingerprints, the sort of DNA of the guitar really go back to this instrument, the oud, which the oud became the lute, and the lute sort of influenced the guitar. And so, you know, any kid shredding Van Halen tunes has the oud to thank for their love of the guitar, because the oud is in the backdrop. And Ronnie also sings beautifully and plays percussion and plays harmonium, which is an Indian instrument. And so he's where I've learned a great deal about this music. He is a master player of Arabic music, and then in the tradition was taught by his father. He's a teacher at the Old Town School of Folk Music and really thought of as an expert in this music. When somebody wants to learn something about Arabic music, you know, Ronnie is a go-to person. And I've learned so much from him. But it's been really, to his credit, that, again, the project is not about playing traditional music. And so I've had to bring him over to an aesthetic that he might not have been completely experienced with before, a kind of classical chamber music aesthetic, a jazz aesthetic, which, though he might have interest in, wasn't part of his experience. And so it's been a real lovely meeting of worlds. And I've learned a lot from him. I hope he's learned a lot from me. And so between the four of us, you have this traditional dance musician, you have this master percussionist who knows percussion techniques from around the world, you have a traditional Arabic musician who's deeply versed in that music, and you have me coming from a jazz and classical background with avant-garde leanings. It's a pretty interesting mix of possibilities there. And I've crafted music. The compositions that I create for the group are really try to indulge those specific interests, those specific threads that make up the tapestry. And I'm actually writing some new things right now, even this week, for this tour coming up. And it's just wonderful to conceive of music specifically for these musicians. It's not just music that I'm writing. I'm writing for Jeremiah, Tim, Ronnie, and myself. And that's a composer's dream. You know, it's what we're always striving for, is to write for something specific, not just music, but for people.
Right. You've got three top players in their respective fields in Alos Musica. And when you get together, do you put a music stand in front of them and a bunch of sheets of paper, or is that how it begins? Or do you?
Yeah, we do start that way. Only for the reason of just pure transmission. You know, I have to get what's in my head
right to
them. And you know, Jeremiah will fly in on Wednesday, and we have our first gig on Friday, and on Saturday we're in Kalamazoo. So we don't have a whole lot of time to put the stuff together, but. But a lot of the repertoire is stuff that we've all played with, if not together as a quartet, then individually. But I've clocked a lot of time with these musicians at this point, and so the ability to speak to each other you know, musically and even just with minimal words to express what it is that I'm looking for with these compositions, I know from experience with them that it'll be very easy. And we're all good friends, and we have such similar kinds of backgrounds. Even when they're disparate, they still have similar kinds of interests and whatnot. So, but yeah, we do start with a sheet. But I would suspect by the time we get to Kalamazoo, or at least we're playing back in Chicago the day after Kalamazoo, and then we go to Iowa. By the time we get to that last gig, I would bet the sheets will be gone, and we'll just be playing, you know, into each other's eyes, so to speak. That's always when it's the best. But some of the music is long that I create. It is longer form, and it is complicated. They're not just tunes; they're compositions. And so, you know, some of it we will be reading even by the end of the week, only because it would be a lot to commit to memory. Although we certainly could and would benefit from it.
Yeah, what I'm picturing based on your background is you could have what you might call through composed sections that are very specific, and then of course in a jazz chart you would start with the melody and then break away to have, you know, the chords continue and everybody play their take on it and then come back for everything back together again. Are these the kind of structures you play with and work with?
Yeah, in a nutshell, yes, they are. The balance between the through composed and the improvised is really what I'm interested in as a composer.
Yeah.
So there will be moments that are totally scripted. Everybody has a part to play. And then there'll be moments when things will break off from there. And perhaps some people are improvising while somebody else is playing a composed part. And that might then switch. And different people will come out of the textures, et cetera. So not quite in a jazz sense where there'll be a tune and then a set of chord changes. And then we go back to the tune. It won't be like that. It'll be more, if you think of it, more like a chamber music setting. Let's say, you know, I don't know, a string quartet, a more modern string quartet. But then imagine in the middle of that a section where there is improvisation happening. And then it might go back to a through composed part and then back to some improvisation. And then, so my joy is when somebody will say to me that they couldn't tell what was improvised and what was composed. That to me is that I'm things are working the way that I want them to work. I really like that back and forth, and you know, and maybe we'll be getting here in our conversation, but that actually is a kind of theological concept to me. This idea that I've been working with for years called the already and the not yet, which is this idea that for me improvisation is a very spiritual practice, and that you're mimicking life's challenges in many ways, that we are constantly improvising as human beings, but there's also a lot that has already happened and we've experienced the already, and yet we're experiencing in the here and now the not yet. And the ways in which we have to balance those two things is one of life's great challenges, for sure. And so I think improvised music, or music that goes back and forth between improvised and composed, really mirrors that life experience. And that's the music I've been drawn to my whole life, in jazz, in Arabic music, which makes great use of improvisation, and even in classical music to an extent. Of course, the classical tradition in Western classical music has taken improvisation out, but the spirit of improvisation, say in a Bach cello suite or in a Mozart piano concerto, I would say that there's that kind of freedom, or that balance between form and freedom is still there.
All right. Well, take away your drummer, your accordionist, and your oud player, and it's you all by yourself with your clarinet.
Yeah.
And you'll be in Holy Family Chapel with a silent audience and the, you know, strange hummings and resonances of the room.
Mm-hmm.
What happens then?
Yeah, that's a good question, isn't it? I'm very much looking forward to that, and I have played in that space before a few years ago, and so I think it's going to be a wonderful place. Betsy, who invited me to come do it, I think she really had the right idea about this solo work in that space. The solo piece, A Sigh Too Deep for Words, which takes its title from some words of St. Paul in one of his letters in the New Testament, it was really meant as it's a kind of composed slash improvised piece that is meant to use improvisation as a metaphor for spiritual practice, for meditation, for prayer, etc. And so I try to, what I think people will hear and what I hope they will hear is something that is very intentional but is happening slowly. And so I take my time in this piece. I develop themes and ideas slowly. And I indulge sound and I indulge silence and try to let those two things really speak to each other. So in addition to clarinet, I'll also be playing some different kinds of bells from around the world, some Tibetan singing bowls, and some other kinds of bells that I'll be playing by hand. I also have a new instrument that I'll be bringing along, which is called a Shruti box, which is an instrument that usually accompanies Indian classical music. And I've just recently had one made in England and had a foot pedal made for it so that I could control it while I'm playing the clarinet. And it's a beautiful-sounding drone instrument, and it provides some texture to the solo clarinet work. And so you'll hear some very quiet and soft and languid and perhaps, I hope, even beautiful tones coming out of the clarinet. And then you'll hear sometimes in my improvisation when there'll be some real struggle, some things that I'll be indulging the parts of the spiritual practice that are full of doubt and are full of wanderings and are full of the dark night of the soul, to quote Kierkegaard, and to those parts that are about the kind of pain and struggle of life experience. And that's what I feel like St. Paul was referring to, these sighs that are too deep for words, this kind of this language that goes beyond the spoken language. And for me, music is that language, and specifically improvised music even heightens that sense. And so I really hope that the listener will be on the journey with me and that they will allow me to lead them through a kind of meditative moment that might last upwards of 35 or 40 minutes. And if I do my work well, but that experience for them will go through the variety of experiences we have as spiritual people, whether they are consider themselves spiritual or not. You know, life is full of mystery, right? And I just think that part of what I want to bring out in this piece is that experience of that mystery. And sometimes it's full of joy and beauty and contemplative nature, and sometimes it's full of struggle and angst and a sense of not knowing how things are going to turn out. And I would hope that all of that is represented in what I play. So I've been doing solo playing for the better part of 2 or 3 years now, pretty consistently all over the world, and I care a lot about it. It's one of my most important projects that I'm working on. And I specifically, I've thought a lot about what it means to play solo. It's kind of an indulgent thing to think that I can, you know, entertain people who paid money to come and just hear a solo clarinetist as a bit of an indulgence. But I've thought a lot about the audience and trying to break down that fourth wall so that they're there with me. It's funny, if I can make another comparison, I just got done working with my students. I teach at Columbia College in Chicago, which is an arts-focused college. And I teach, for lack of a better term, a kind of philosophy of the arts class. And I just got done working with them with the performance artist named Marina Abramovic. And she's a controversial figure, and I don't mean to say that I'm a huge fan of what she does. But we were specifically working with this piece where she sat in a chair at MoMA in New York and had people come and sit across from her. It's called The Artist is Present. You know, it was quite popular back about 3 or 4 years ago, and you might have experienced it or know about it.
And it became a bit of a phenomenon in the art world. But one of the things I so appreciate about that project that she did is that this inclusion of the audience in the art, that they are now a part of making the art experience. And I so much want to break down that wall in my work, whether it be on recording or in performance. I want the listener to feel like they are not just sitting back and experiencing, but that they are actually involved in the process of making. And this piece specifically, the size Too Deep for Words, really tries to make that happen. So the sanctuary there will be, you know, my ideal place to do it. I've played this work at jazz clubs. I've played it at galleries. I've played it in school classrooms. But ideally, it happens in a church setting or some kind of a spiritual place, sacred space.
Is it a little awkward at first, at those first few notes? Does it ever move on and become something where you are accessing music in a way that's not self-conscious?
You've got some great questions. Going to the first part of the question, there is something that's, well, I wouldn't use the term awkward. There's something that's very vulnerable for us all in those first notes, you know. It's like, the, you know, if you and I were to meet in person today, there's always that just moment when you're just trying to, okay, is this a warm person? Is this, do I have some kind of connection with this person? And, you know, within a couple of minutes, you just start to get that feeling. And so those first gestures that I offer the audience are important, and they're, but they are also, in improvisation, it's always about paying deep attention to the moment and to making the next moment relate to that previous moment, or somehow changing things. If you think you need to move in a different direction, then that's important as well. So those opening moments are important. I wouldn't say awkward, but pregnant with meaning and possibility. You know? And yes, if all goes well, I will sort of lose myself, but always present, always concentrating, but that I will be so involved in what I'm doing that the audience kind of slips away from my consciousness for a moment or two. I recorded this piece in a video format a few years ago, and it's up on my website as a free bit. You can just watch the whole thing. It's about almost an hour-long performance that took place in a small recording studio with about 20 people in the audience. And you know, I purposely had it presented it as a video because I wanted people to see the experience of what I was going through when I was performing. And you can see moments when I'm right engaged in everything I'm doing and I'm very intentional, and it's like, yeah, he's right in there. And then there are moments when I'm just floundering. and to me, it's important to have both of those things represented, because that is the already and the not yet. That is the experience of life, of making sense of things. And then there are times when you're, yep, I know exactly what I'm doing here. And then there are moments when you're searching. And the beauty of improvised music is being along on that whole search, that whole process.
Right. And who can't relate to that?
Yeah, exactly. I certainly can. I feel like I spend most of my time in the not yet, like wondering what's happening in life. And you know, that's what I'm trying to represent in this piece. And so, and I also do something, it's in the video, and I'll probably do it again in Kalamazoo, is I actually move around the space to try to represent different possibilities of on the journey. So I'll actually physically get up and change chairs, or at some point I might stand in a certain place. And depending, I'm going to spend some time in that sanctuary again, and maybe I can even play up in the balcony at one point or walk around the space. And it the piece allows that sort of exploration of how space and the body actually changes the experience of the music. We forget that in music a lot. We spend a lot of time sitting in chairs and just, you know, just playing to people, and it's all about the mind and the ears. But the physical part of this work is important to me. And it's no
surprise, and I'm almost making sense of this as I'm saying it, that the last couple of years I've been working with dancers more, and they have gotten me really to think more about how I use my body in my playing. The clarinet is a very awkward thing to play. I mean, it's such a weird instrument. There's no way to not round your shoulders off, and you got this thing in your mouth, and you're blowing your brains out, and the veins pop out of my head after a while, and it's a very strange thing to do. I mean, playing any instrument in some ways is a very weird thing for the body to do. That's why a lot of us have various ailments with our hands and arms and pinched nerves and whatnot. But these dancer friends of mine have just encouraged me to think about the ways in which I'm carrying myself while I'm playing, and how that transmits the music in some different ways. So I've tried to incorporate that into this piece. There's no dancing, I can assure you, no dancing, but just movement and the way the body transmits sound.
Well, James, I think we have to end it here, but I have a feeling, since Kalamazoo's not too far away, that you will find ways to bring more exciting musical projects now and in the future to Kalamazoo.
Well, I would love it. It's, be about my fourth or fifth time back there performing, and every time has been a real joy. So I'm very much looking forward to presenting both of these projects. Both of them are very near and dear to me and the center of my work, and so I couldn't ask for a better presentation of who I am.
Well, thank you for your time. You've been so generous.
My pleasure. Thank you.